This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. I use it with my patients at the Hoffman Center all the time. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, the company is offering you special savings of $50 and free shipping. To find out more, go to TryZonaNow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman to get your $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662 or tryzonanow.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Your questions can be related to nutrition, or they can be related to integrative medicine. If you have a comment on something that's happening on the holistic scene, whether it's about food, whether it's about environment, whether it's about the politics of natural medicine, those are important topics too. Send your emails to radioprogram@AOL.com, radioprogram@AOL.com. We have, as of recently, 2.5 million downloads of our podcasts. Our podcasts include a weekly Q&A with Layla, and also we interview distinguished guests, and I expound on clinical-focused topics of my choosing during the week, in addition to our weekend radio program. Today we're with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. How you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you doing?
Good. Layla is a registered dietitian, and she has a master's degree in the field of nutrition. And she is a CDN, whatever that is.
Certified Dietitian Nutritionist.
Right. And that enables you to practice legally in New York, correct?
Right.
But a lot of people...
The RD credential allows me to practice nationally.
But, you know, a lot of people dispense nutritional information without those credentials. And,
oh,
you know,
that's true, yeah.
Sometimes they do a pretty good job, and sometimes they're maybe a little less science-based in their nutritional recommendations. But, you know, we play it straight and narrow. I'm an MD, you're an RD, and an MA. Mm-hmm. And we...
MS,
I'm sorry. And we expand on our knowledge base... And depart from our conventional training. So, before we get to questions, this week, and I actually broached this on my weekend radio program, and I'll share this with you. I don't know if you've seen it yet, but it's a kind of a alarming story about calcium supplementation. Layla, do you remember the scare recently about the potential for calcium supplements to increase the risk of arterial calcification? Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of gone back and forth, because there's some studies that suggest that there is a correlation between arterial calcification and high intake of calcium. And then other studies exonerate calcium. So we're kind of left high and dry in relationship to the coronary heart disease connection with calcium supplementation. But this week, an article appeared, and the headline here is, calcium supplements linked to higher risk of dementia in some women. Now, here's the story. By the way, and this does not suggest that dementia is caused by calcium, right? Because this is a multiplicity of causes. But for a certain subset of women, perhaps men, but the study was done on women, and logically enough, because I think women are the major consumers of calcium because they're worried about osteoporosis. Many men are less concerned about osteoporosis. They should be, because men do get osteoporosis. But nonetheless, the study was done in women. Researchers found that women who had previously had a stroke and who regularly took calcium supplements were 7 times more likely, I'll repeat that, 7 times more likely to develop dementia over the 5-year period in which they were studied than women who'd had a stroke but did not take those supplements. Is that mind-blowing or what?
That's very mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of two different variables here.
Yep.
The same risk factor for stroke is also the same risk factor for dementia. I'm thinking specifically of homocysteine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering about the calcium thing. Are we talking about blockages in the carotid arteries where it's a dementia of not getting enough blood flow?
No, I have a theory about this, but let me embellish the story a little bit. Additionally, the researchers found that women who had signs of a disorder that affects blood flow in the brain. Okay, this article is written for lay people. The medical term for that disorder is vascular dementia, a disorder that affects blood flow in the brain, and who regularly took calcium supplements were twice as likely to develop dementia over 5 years as women who had signs of this disorder, vascular dementia, but did not take those supplements. So here's the deal. I had a theory about this, and the theory goes as following. You know, when you have some kind of vascular injury, or any injury, say you injure your shoulder, what happens? On a subsequent x-ray, you'll see calcification forming. It's part of the healing process when there's inflammation or injury. And when your arteries are injured or inflamed, or as in a stroke, literally there's a lot of damage to your arteries, calcium comes in, kind of like super glue to try and mend the damage. And I think that if you over consume calcium, you get too much super glue in the repair process. That's what I'm thinking here.
Well, that makes complete sense.
Yeah.
So, well, you know, the original studies that talked about calcium in coronary artery disease, the bottom line of that, according to anything I've read, is taking, you know, calcium supplementation in the absence
in isolation
of vitamin K.
Yeah. In isolation, yes, or essentially, perhaps without a balance with magnesium, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
Because in the old days, and you remember these days, in the 90s, were you around then? Were you born then? I don't even know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to blow your cover. Okay, but I remember the 90s. And in the 90s, and in the late 80s even, they were recommending that women take 1,500 milligrams of Tums every day for osteoporosis prevention. And we know now that calcium, very trivial effect on osteoporosis, maybe a 1 or 2% protective effect. So calcium alone doesn't do the trick. You need all these cofactors. If you're going to have a med, you need the vitamin D, of course. So the question is, if women were taking calcium as part of a balanced program, say with vitamin K2 that prevents atherosclerosis, with adequate vitamin D, with adequate magnesium and other cofactors, and if they were on a really good diet, would this also occur? But it's a bit of I call this a little bit of a yellow flag on overzealous calcium consumption. You know, we saw a woman, this morning in the office earlier today, and she had had a stroke. And so my first question to her was, are you taking calcium? And I was almost certain, you know, she's a 76-year-old woman, that she would be taking calcium. But she apparently wasn't caught up in this osteoporosis paranoia that got her to take a lot of calcium. She said, no, I don't take calcium. She takes magnesium, but no calcium. So that's good, because you will put yourself at higher risk if you take a lot of calcium now that you've had a stroke.
Yeah. Well, you know, Dr. Hoffman, and this is something I've actually podcasted extensively about. When we do a blood test, you know, that metabolic panel or the comprehensive metabolic panel where we see the potassium and the sodium, nobody ever comes back low in calcium. So why do we keep throwing calcium at a problem? We see low vitamin D, we supplement with vitamin D. We see low magnesium, we supplement with magnesium.
Mm-hmm.
There's really no test for vitamin K unless you think it should be something like osteocalcin.
Right, or possibly a proton or something.
Prophylactically,
like that.
And I think most people should be taking it anyway to make sure any calcium is going to the right place.
Yep.
So all this calcium we've been telling everybody to take may be winding up as those studies that say is contributing to coronary artery plaque or to cardiovascular disease, but in the absence of vitamin K.
Right.
And I think this is very important.
I'm going to paraphrase the old song. It's looking for calcium in all the wrong places. You know, looking for love in all the wrong places. Looking for calcium in all the wrong places. Because what happens in the aging process for a lot of people is there's a dysregulation of calcium metabolism. And instead of keeping your calcium in your bones, it comes out of your bones and it goes into your tissues and it goes into your arterial walls. And mm-hmm. vitamin K acts as a little bit of a traffic cop to redirect the calcium back to where it belongs in the bones and to keep it away from critical circulatory vessels.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and not just the blood vessels. It can wind up in other places like soft tissue,
yep.
like in breast tissue with suspicious
yep.
calcification. So there's all of that.
Yep.
And, you know, the vitamin K, the different types of vitamin K, K1, K2, K1 is really more about homeostasis. We're getting more of that K from the green leafy vegetables. That's more about homeostasis in the body. But the K2, we're getting other places like natto. We're getting it from meat. We're getting it from cheese to some extent
mm-hmm.
as well.
That's
I know in the Japanese diet, they get a lot from natto.
That's the Dutch paradox is that there's less coronary artery disease in the Netherlands, where there's mm-hmm. a very high consumption of high-fat dairy, but it's in the form of cheese that's rich in vitamin K. And similarly
yeah.
in Japan, they have something called natto. Can you explain what natto is to our listeners not familiar with that?
Natto is like it's a fermented soy,
mm-hmm.
is it not?
Yeah.
Or fermented, yeah.
And it's sort of like, I have to say, it's sort of cheesy, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's an acquired taste, let's put it that way. It's a lot of Westerners can't cotton to natto. But I remember that I was interviewed by Japanese TV in the 1980s. They came to my office with film crew to, mm-hmm. because they were very excited to find an American doctor who endorsed natto. Back in the 80s before it became sort of a popular food. And we recognize uh-huh. that it has protective properties. It also, it's a rich source of vitamin K2, which is the, you know, so the Japanese said uses traditional food and it was protective. But we've gotten off topic,
yeah.
so, as we usually do. But this is one big stream of consciousness program if you haven't already realized that, audience. So let's take a question. And
yeah. Okay. All right. We've got an email from John. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I thought the question of which is better had been settled, but then I came across something, and it's about which is better, and does it really matter? We're talking about ubiquinol versus ubiquinone.
Mm-hmm.
And does it really matter? And basically, he emailed us the link to a Jarrow article.
Yep.
And basically, ubiquinone is the oxidized form, which is essential for CoQ10's role in cellular energy metabolism
mm-hmm.
for ATP. And ubiquinol is the reduced form.
Right.
Which is essential for the antioxidant function of CoQ10.
Right.
And because they kind of go back and forth in terms of its conversion from ubiquinol to ubiquinone, because it's going from oxidized to reduced, that the conclusion is it doesn't really matter that much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, you know, I have to say that I've been a big proponent of ubiquinol. And, you know, one of the reasons for that is that one of the original CoQ10 researchers, it's actually kind of a family tradition to study CoQ10. And the son actually is a big proponent of ubiquinol because in research they could not get high enough blood levels with CoQ10 alone, the ubiquinone, which is the oxidized
uh-huh.
form. And they use ubiquinol and they managed to get higher levels. And this is in a lot of published data. Now, I think there's been a little blowback against that because some people accuse the ubiquinol folks of marketing hype. You know, that they're overhyping ubiquinol that's more expensive. Certainly there's an impetus to sell something that's more premium and that using CoQ10 is just fine. And then there's also, more, absorbable forms of CoQ10. There's a whole issue of, you know, the bioavailability, the vehicle in which you provide it. You know, is it going to, is it micelized? Is it breakdown? Is it absorbed? And, you know, and so on. It's not you are what you eat, it's what you absorb. So, you know, I respect the people at Jarrow for pushing back a little bit on that. I think it's fine if you want to take coenzyme Q10. I still recommend ubiquinol to most of my patients, and I take ubiquinol myself.
I take ubiquinol, too. But,
yeah.
You know, Dr. Hoffman, I do actually feel a difference between CoQ10
oh,
and ubiquinol.
Okay.
Ubiquinol, I feel superior.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
But, you know, it could be, well, how much of this is the power of suggestion? Because right. it's not like I'm double-blinding myself and saying which supplement yeah. am I taking either. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know I'm taking ubiquinol.
Yeah. That's true. There's the power
yeah,
of suggestion.
I don't know.
You know.
So just to make it fair.
You're administering a placebo to yourself.
Right.
right? So it's like, that's not only, see, in a double blind, both the experimenter and the subject have to be blinded. In this case,
exactly.
neither is blinded. So it's a no blind study.
Right.
Totally anecdotal. All right. So, what of interest to me, and this is just appearing on the horizon, is a new product called MitoQ, MitoQ. And it's a proprietary delivery system for, basically for CoQ10. But it's of interest is that you can use much lower doses. You can use 5 milligrams or 10 milligrams, and it purports to deliver, even greater benefits. I'm tantalizing our listeners with information about this, but I don't know much more about it. I'm just beginning to take a look at it, but it may be something that, comes into the marketplace and becomes more, widely used. It is expensive, but in a recent study, they gave patients with fibromyalgia MitoQ, and what they found was that, there was substantial relief from the symptoms of fibromyalgia,
wow.
with MitoQ. But I believe it might have been compared, to regular coenzyme Q10. And there wasn't it wasn't as efficacious. So we're going to keep our eye on that. Again, this might just be a fad or a flash in the pan, but there was some independent studies suggesting that MitoQ might be the latest iteration of CoQ10 technology.
Yeah. Well, if they find out more and more and make it better and better, all the more. The better outcomes we can then expect.
Indeed.
In public health, in our patients, all of that. It's all very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So, yeah,
and I have to say that CoQ10, yeah. I think, is one of the real substantial players in this marketplace. Yeah. It's not often that an innovation like that comes along in terms of nutrition. I would rank it with magnesium, fish oil, and curcumin, resveratrol, vitamin D, in terms of legitimacy, in terms of, it's going to be around in one form or another, and there are real tangible benefits for prevention, for anti-aging, for subjective well-being, as well as for specific conditions, possibly neurological conditions like Parkinson's, although they did a Parkinson's study. The Parkinson's study did not come out too positively. Maybe they weren't using enough or they were using a pretty high dose, but, something they could have been more aggressive about the dosing.
I think ubiquinol is even more important today because every other person is on a statin.
Oh, yeah. Goes without saying
that there's more and more congestive heart failure.
Yeah, it goes without saying if you're on a statin, you must be on coenzyme Q10. We got to get the message out.
Yeah. So, John, thank you very, very much for your question.
Indeed.
All right. We have a different John emailing.
How peculiar. How peculiar that two Johns.
How peculiar.
That's really strange. That doesn't happen
every
day.
Yeah, the first was from, I believe, New Jersey, and the second one is from Long Island. Hi, Doc and Layla. Love your show. Thanks so much for the critical information you bring to us. You're welcome. My good friend has Factor V laden and was prescribed warfarin.
Right.
Are there any nutritional supplements or dietary regimens you would recommend that would be helpful?
Okay. So what factor, it's actually, the V is a Roman numeral. So you know what a V stands for?
Oh,
Roman,
factor
Roman
5
numeral?
Laden. Leiden.
You know, there's a...
Yeah,
there, there's
factor
a,
5.
You know, there's a joke, a Roman, walks into a bar and flashes the V signal. And the bartender shrugs his shoulders as if to, what do you mean? And he says, give me 5. Give me five. Whatever. Okay. Five drinks. It's a V. V stands for five. So it's Factor 5 Leiden.
Uh-huh.
And this is a, let's back up. When somebody gets a blood clot, say they get a blood clot in their leg or they get a pulmonary embolus, then it is, and I'm sure that they have, for a poster girl for this is Hillary Clinton. She had a blood clot in her brain. And I'm sure they did this workup on her. Now, they don't screen people routinely for these things. They wait until you have an event, and then they do a panel. So look at a variety of things. One of the things they look at is homocysteine, because elevated homocysteine also increases the risk of blood clots. But they do, you know, various protein C and a bunch of different things, a whole panel. That's a hematologists are familiar with this. And when, if factor 5 Leiden comes up, then they know that you are at risk for a blood clot. And therefore, they need to undertake an aggressive program of prevention. And that prevention, I mean, you could take an aspirin, but that may not be enough, so they put you on Coumadin. So the question is there an alternative to Coumadin? Is that the question?
Other blood-thinning medications. So in this population where they have this genetic mutation that gives them this condition, you know, aspirin or something like that wouldn't cover. It has to be something as powerful as Coumadin.
I think that because a stroke or pulmonary embolus, so devastating that I think that they don't want to take a chance. And that's,
that makes sense,
you know, you may get away with, say, taking an aspirin with vitamin E and ginkgo and a lot of fish oil, some ginger, garlic in high doses. You know, you might do fine, but do you want to gamble with the potential for losing part of your brain? You know, that's what's at stake if you're at risk for a stroke.
Yeah.
And this is a little bit of a corollary to the question of so many people ask us, you know, they have atrial fibrillation and they're put on Pradaxa or they're put on Coumadin or, you know, either the traditional old-fashioned blood thinner like Coumadin or one of the newer ones. And they ask, is there an alternative? And the answer is, you know, you might be taking a chance by not being aggressive about thinning your blood.
Yeah. And then, speaking of vitamin K, anybody taking Coumadin, warfarin?
That's not for you.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you don't necessarily take a vitamin K supplement, but you're allowed to eat the vegetables that contain vitamin K. However, you want to keep it consistent on a day-to-day basis and not more than, say, you know, a serving or two of spinach a day and broccoli, and that's it.
Now,
you don't want to go overboard.
Layla, are you in touch enough with the registered dietitian community, you know, your own professional societies, to know whether they have eased up on this horrible advice that they used to give people? Don't eat any green leafy vegetables, you know, avoid all these foods that have vitamin K, so that...
You know what I'm finding out? What I find out more than anything, it's not the RD who's telling them not to eat their vegetables, it's the nurse who's counseling the person.
Oh.
Yeah. It's the nurse saying, don't eat any vegetables, and sending them on their way.
Right. So that, which suggests that there's a little more nuanced understanding now among registered dietitians that it's permissible to have a little bit, as long as you measure your ProTime or your INR faithfully, because that's the name of the game, is that you, whatever vegetables you're eating, you want the Coumadin dose to achieve a certain INR, which is, you know, 2 to 2.5 times the control. You know, and a nurse might kind of take it too literally that vitamin K antagonizes Coumadin, so don't eat any vitamin K. Well, if you don't eat any vitamin K, well, you'll have some serious problems. And the very self-same people who are taking these medications do have a high risk for cerebrovascular disease and for atherosclerosis and heart attacks. And if they don't get enough vitamin K, they'll be even worse off.
Right. So that's really where I'm finding that the advice comes from. Oh, the nurse told me no vegetables. The nurse told me.
Right.
Yeah, I hear that more than anything.
And
because, you know, doctors are not referring the patient to the RD.
Right.
For any of that explanation.
Right.
So.
Yeah, there's, you know, for every RD, there's like 20 nurses. And,
right.
You know, and it's, you know, we, our office, we share, we don't share an office, but adjacent to our office is a nursing school. And I have to say, I'm a little disappointed that they have not tapped us to address their nursing staff. I mean, I know they are a very tight curriculum. They have to teach them, you know, drugs, and they have to teach them pharmacology, and they have to basic anatomy. But, man, they got a great resource in us, and we could have delivered a couple of lectures that I think could have really brought up their awareness. But they're in a big hurry to cram a lot of information to those young people's heads. And this, you know, not enough nutrition curriculum, other than maybe, you know, eat a low-fat diet.
Right, eat a low-fat diet.
Right.
And maybe spend an hour on water and electrolytes, and that's about it.
All right, well, so be it. But there's an emerging understanding among RDs that supplements have their place, and that, you know, some of the old orthodoxy is being turned over. Okay, this is a good point in which to pause, because we divide our podcast into two parts, as our listeners know. What's in store for us in part two? Give us a tease.
I'm taking Nexium, but my belly ache keeps coming back when I divert away from a FODMAP diet.
Okay. Yeah. All right. We'll address that question when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, and you can rejoin us in part two.